Well, as you can see by the reading we just had then, what we're looking at tonight is we're continuing in that moment, and we looked at it last week, the moment which many would argue is the most significant moment in history, the death of Jesus. And tonight we look at really the final few hours, the final few breaths that Jesus takes, and why it is so significant, or evidence that it is the most significant event in history. Now, thinking more generally about significant events, and as I've reflected on other significant events that have kind of happened in my life, they're the kind of events that that you never forget. Yeah, they're the events that change you somehow, or they change the way you think, the way you operate. They change the world you live in somehow. And I'm thinking particularly when heavy things go down. Big things that go down that kind of stop our nation or bring people to a standstill. And even just in recent history, I can think of a number of things that have really kind of rocked our world, changed the way we think and operate. And I'll certainly never forget them. So just in more recent history, in my lifetime, and there's probably many that you can remember as well, but here's some things that stand out to me. I remember when Princess Diana died. Now, some of you may, that might have been before you were born, I'm not sure, but I know how old I was because I was in Grace Brothers at the time. Grace Brothers is what Maya used to be called before it went cool. And my fiance and I were standing in Grace Brothers putting together the wedding registry thing. So I remember the moment. And as we were walking around and looking at what we, you know, it's your wish list, isn't it? It's such a weird moment where you get to walk around and go, yep, that, people are going to buy this stuff for me, so I'm just going to tick everything. Most expensive things that are around. It's ridiculous. You only get one moment to do it, so you may as well go for it. Anyway, walking around doing that, having a good old time, then we noticed all these people standing around the tellies, around the television section, and back when the tellies were still kind of curved. Although they've gone back to being curved now, have you noticed? Yeah, they keep changing. They keep coming up with new reasons why we need to buy new tellies. Anyway, everyone was standing around the tellies and we wandered over to see what was happening. A lot of people had just had tears in their eyes and they were just really horrified, and we could see that something had happened. Princess Diana was killed in a car accident. Now, I didn't think Aussies were that into royals, but apparently we are. And apparently there's something about Diana that was very key to people and their identity. And when she was killed like that, it was quite a moment for a lot of people, a moment that people never forget. A lot of people remember where they were. I remember where I was when the Twin Towers collapsed in New York with the terrorist attack. That was a huge moment. I was having, previous to being here, I come from the Shire, don't hold that against me. That's why I come from the Shire. And we were having a staff meeting in my house and people were just arriving and the news, we'd heard the news. So instead of starting with our staff meeting, we sat down and just watched the telly and just watched these images over and over again, and then started to just pray. So we spent most of the morning praying and it was a really weird moment. Now, we were just about to have our first child, and I remember thinking, what kind of a world are we bringing our child into? What changes are going to happen? Is this something that's just going to be global? And really, many would say, since that moment of September 11, the way we view the world and the way we view a number of things has really changed the way we operate. You know, when big things go down, they change us. I remember with the Bali bombings, because I'd been in that very area a number of times in Bali, and to see that whole place blow up and to know many of my friends who had friends who passed away and were killed in that. There was a monument erected, you know, in my hometown back in the Shire. Big moments. The cafe siege that happened in our own city just 3 months ago. That'll be a big moment. And they reopened the Lint Cafe, I think, just a couple of days ago. These are big moments that go down that kind of stop a nation and get us thinking and change the way we live and think. Significant events change us. They change our culture. But Christians, and even beyond the Christian world, would say that there is the most significant event that's gone down in history that's changed the world more than anything else. It's the event that has not been forgotten for 2,000 years, and it is the event of the death of Jesus, the one who was truly a man and also claimed to be God the Son at the very same time. The moment he dies, I want to suggest, is the moment that had more impact on our world than any other event that's gone down in history. Do you see that event as the most significant one? And if so, How has it changed you? Because it certainly changed our world. We want to look at this event again tonight. We just want to work through the details of it and really just feel it, feel the significance of it, these final hours of Jesus' life. And one of the ways we'll do that is just observe what happened as Jesus was hanging there on the cross and dying. And observe the way the people who were witnessing it reacted and responded to see, hopefully, something huge went down when Jesus died on the cross. The people who were standing around observing and watching, there was a number of ways in which there was a response to the death of Jesus. You see Jesus himself with a loud cry. You see the people standing around witnessing. You see the temple itself responding and reacting. You see creation reacting and responding. Something huge went down. We need to figure out what it is and make sure we understand the significance and live in light of this event. So let's work through those categories. I want to start with creation. How does the creation itself respond to the death of Jesus? Well, we get told one very key thing there, verse 44. Have a look at it. I think in the newer, and I've got my older NIV here. Lost my newer one, so sorry. Going back to 84. It was now about the sixth hour, and darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour, for the sun had stopped shining. Now, some of you in the newer NIV, you've got it was noon until three. That's the case. Back in the first century, the first hour of the day was the day the sun came up. So the sixth hour was about noon. Ninth hour was about three in the afternoon. But what we're told here is that smack bang in the middle of the day, it goes dark. At the moment in the day where the sun is at the highest point and brightest and strongest, it shuts down and the whole place goes dark for 3 hours. Now that's got to be a spooky moment, yeah? Creation is responding to this moment as Jesus hangs on the cross. No one would have missed this moment. The whole place goes dark in the middle of the day. Everything would have just ground to a halt. All work, particularly work outside, everyone would have just stopped what they were doing and at least just wondered, what's going on? Something big is going down here. Some would suggest as I look back at this, it was just an eclipse. Problem is, according to our calculations, wrong time of year for an eclipse, a lunar eclipse like that, if that's what people suggest it was. And also, eclipses don't usually last for 3 hours if you ever tried to sit up and watch one or... Not sit up and watch one during the day, which you're not meant to do. You're meant to have special glasses. They don't go for 3 hours. But even if God did intend to use some natural mechanism, like a lunar eclipse, to block the sun out for 3 hours, he chose to do it at this particular moment in time to make a point through his creation so that everyone would see, guys, something big is going down in this moment. Spooky, frightening, haunting, no doubt for many who are watching. But what do we make of the significance of the darkness? Well, there's a couple of things you might notice. Back in chapter 22, verse 53, if you flick back there for a minute, here's look at Jesus' own words when he says to the guards as they come to arrest him. He says, "Every day I was with you in the temple courts and you did not lay a hand on me, but this is your hour, the hour when darkness reigns." So Jesus already talked about it. This is going to be the moment where darkness reigns, where his enemies actually have some level of triumph over him and their evil seems to have the victory. It's likely fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, this moment of darkness. There's a couple of key Old Testament prophetic texts, like particularly Zephaniah 1, you've got Amos, a number of mentions in there, and you've got Joel 2. They're just some of the Old Testament prophets who prophesied about a day that would come, and it's often referred to as the day of the Lord. And the day of the Lord is the day that the Lord would come and judge and pour out his wrath. And that moment is described as, often, time and time again, as the moment of darkness, the moment where blackness comes over the land. There's continual references to this because the moment God's wrath and judgment comes on this place, there will be darkness. There will be blackness. And so it really is no surprise then, is it, that creation responds like this to this moment as Jesus hangs on the cross. Because if you've been digging into the significance with us over the last few weeks, you'll see that as Jesus was hanging there on the cross, it was far more than simply a physical death. The spiritual significance of what was happening there in Jesus was huge. Jesus was taking on himself the judgment that the world deserves. Jesus was absorbing in himself the wrath of God that you and I and all of humanity deserved. Jesus uses the language when he talks about, when he prays, when he's in the garden, he says, "Lord, can you take this cup from me?" That language of cup is language about the cup of the Lord's wrath. And Jesus is basically saying, I'm just about to drink the cup of wrath for you and all of humanity, so you don't need to drink it for yourself. And the cup with your name on it and my name on it is taken by Jesus, and he drinks it and drains it and bears in his body on the cross the punishment that you and I actually deserve. So there in this moment as Jesus hangs there, it's not just physical torment, though that was horrific. It's spiritual torment. He cries out in some of the other Gospels, my God, why have you forsaken me? In this moment, Jesus is in a very real sense forsaken from the Father as he absorbs the Father's wrath. It's no surprise, is it, that as that moment is happening, the whole place goes dark. As the judgment of God is being funneled down onto his Son in this moment, the place goes black, and it goes black for 3 hours. That just makes sense, doesn't it? When you see the significance, the spiritual significance of this moment, darkness comes over the land. Now, in Matthew's gospel, you get a little bit more detail about the way creation responds as well. You don't get it here in Luke, but you get it in Matthew. And there's a few other things that creation does to respond. Apparently, at this very same moment as it going dark, there was also an earthquake. So the whole ground starts to tremble and shake, and things start to crack and break open, including tombs where dead people are. And in Matthew's gospel, it actually talks about how some of those dead people came out of the tombs and walked around. And actually, when Jesus is resurrected himself, those dead people who have come to life actually gather in Jerusalem, and everyone sees them. Creation responds with darkness, an earthquake, and dead people coming back to life, walking out of tombs. Now, when you step back from that, that sounds like a horror film, doesn't it? You know, someone's flicked out the lights, the whole joint shaking, and then dead people, zombies are walking around. You know, it's like this is scary stuff. This is striking, at least. It's the kind of thing that no one would have been able to ignore. In fact, later on in Luke, when Jesus does rise from the dead and he's walking along the road with the disciples, they don't know who he is. He's keeping his appearance from them somehow. And there's a little interaction between them where the disciples ask him a question. What do you think about these things that have been happening in Jerusalem? And Jesus, kind of playing hard to get, says, "What things?" And they say, "What do you mean, what things? Everyone knows the things that have been going down, the death of Jesus and everything that happened around it." In other words, it was such a commotion. How could it not be a commotion with darkness, earthquake, dead people coming back to life? Something huge went down as Jesus hung there on the cross and died. That's how creation responds. Second thing, let's look at how the temple responds, which is a building in the first century, but the most significant building in Jerusalem. The temple was the very key structure through which God and people could connect. It was the way people were able to come to God through a priestly system, and God would connect with them. Look at verse 45. How does the temple respond? Halfway through verse 45. "And the curtain of the temple was torn in two." The curtain of the temple was torn in two. Now, if you're unfamiliar with these things, you might think, a curtain gets torn? Big deal. That happens all the time in my house, you know. But the curtain in the temple was a big deal, because we're talking here about a supernatural kind of tearing of a temple curtain that doesn't get torn. We're talking about the curtain that actually was the physical barrier between God and people. It was the curtain that hung down over the most holy place, the place where the Ark of the Covenant was, the very throne room of God, the presence of God was kept behind this curtain in the temple. And the only access that anyone could ever have was once a year, the high priest would enter into the Holy of Holies and offer a sacrifice for the sins of the people. But he had to enter with extreme caution and huge amount of reverence. Tradition actually has it that the high priest would sometimes have a rope tied around his ankle as he went in there because everyone was so concerned that he might do something wrong. And to do something wrong in the presence of a holy God would mean you would drop dead. And we see it happen right throughout history. And if that was the case, no one wanted to go in there and get him. So we just pull him out by his leg, you know. This was the Holy of Holies. You couldn't just run into the presence of God. You couldn't just step in with confidence. No, you had to go with extreme reverence and caution. And it was the curtain that was the physical barrier between God and people, put there for good reason. But it's this curtain that's torn in two. Other Gospels say torn in two from the top to the bottom. In other words, not done by someone standing at the bottom and just ripping it up. And that's impossible anyway, because we're talking about a curtain that was like 5 centimetres thick. That's a thick curtain. I'm not a textiles person, but that's a thick piece of material. You can't tear that with your bare hands. And it's 15 metres high. Those kind of curtains don't just tear on their own. Supernaturally torn because of the significance of what was happening as Jesus hung there on the cross. Something was going to change. The function of the temple was going to be put aside. This whole high priest going in once a year to make connection with God on behalf of the people was going to be no more. This curtain that separated and made it very clear that there was only limited access to God was now ripped apart and removed. Why is that? Well, because as Jesus hung on the cross and died that death, it was the sacrifice of the perfect lamb once for all that would never need to be repeated. It was the sacrifice where Jesus' body is broken and blood is shed so that that curtain can be removed and now there can be access to a holy God through Jesus, the sacrifice. And now we can, with confidence, through Jesus, enter into the presence of our holy God and survive. It's an incredible moment, the moment of Jesus' death. It gives us access. It makes access available to the one who made us, that we can commune with him. And we're going to look at some of the reflections on that in just a moment, what that means for us today. But it's clear, don't you think, by just looking at how creation responds and then how the temple responds, that this time of temple worship, those days are gone. Jesus is the new temple. He's the new curtain. There's a new way now for people to connect with God. This death of Jesus on the cross changes everything. We're living in a whole new age now. There's a new way to connect with God. Thirdly, let's look at what Jesus himself cries out as he hangs there on the cross, because that's going to give us insight into what's happening, the significance of this moment. Look at verse 46. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And when he had said this, he breathed his last. In some of the other Gospels, you get Jesus saying, my God, why have you forsaken me?" which is quoting Psalm 22, and there's certain things to be said in his quote there. Here it seems that Jesus also, either directly after or around the same moment, makes this cry, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." It's an intriguing cry though, isn't it? It certainly means this, doesn't it? If it's true that in that moment Jesus was absorbing the wrath of the Father, it certainly didn't mean that the relationship between he, the Son, and the Father was getting trashed. even as he bore the wrath of God, our shame on himself, he cries out to God, relationship still intact. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. This is still good. I'm coming home. I'm entrusting myself to you. There's confidence in Jesus' voice, even in this horrific moment of his execution. Now, that understanding is kind of only enriched by noticing that as Jesus cries out these words, he's quoting a psalm. It's the psalm that we had read, Psalm 31. So flick back there with me, and then we'll be back in Luke in just a minute. But come to Psalm 31. It's a psalm of David, and usually in the New Testament where a psalm is quoted, the person quoting the psalm is not just wanting you to focus in on that particular line that they said, but they want you to look at the content of the whole psalm. And they're trying to bring the meaning of all of that into this moment and say something about what's happening. And I believe that is largely what Jesus is doing here. He's speaking about how he's going to commit himself into the Father's hands, absolutely. But at the same time, he's kind of saying, Psalm 31, yep. So do you know what Psalm 31 is all about? You need to get the content of Psalm 31. And the content is David, as a righteous man, is actually suffering. He's in distress. He's even feeling cut off and wondering whether God's handed him over to his enemies. But as he cries out for help, he remembers and his confidence in God is restored and he realizes actually God's not let go of him at all. In fact, God's got him in his hands and God's going to keep him safe and protect him and vindicate him. Have a look at some of the language there. We'll read verses 5. You know, into your hands I commit my spirit. Redeem me, O Lord, the God of truth. I hate those who cling to worthless idols. I trust in the Lord. I will be glad and rejoice in your love, for you saw my affliction and knew the anguish of my soul. You have not handed me over to the enemy. You have set my feet in a spacious place. You see what he's saying there? I'm not handed over. I'm actually in a good place right now. It's beautiful. Have a look at verses 14 and 15. Here's David saying, but I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hands. Deliver me from my enemies and from those who pursue me. Let your face shine on your servant. Save me in your unfailing love. So David, in a moment of desperation, is actually realizing his confidence again in a God who's got a hold of him and is in control of all these things. So friends, if Jesus is quoting this psalm, if Jesus wants us to understand that what's going on for him is similar to what was going on for David as he writes this psalm, then here's what Jesus is saying. He's saying, despite my appearance right now of being handed over to my enemies and being completely destroyed by them, despite the appearance of actually them having the victory over me, let me tell you what's really going on. Let me tell you how I'm really feeling. My God is the one I trust. My Father knows what's happening here. My times are in his hands. I've not been handed over to my enemies. I've actually got my feet set on solid ground here, even though I hang in this wretched state. And so even in this moment, I'm going to be glad. And I'm going to rejoice from a very deep place because of my Father's great goodness. Can you believe that Jesus had that going on in his heart and his mind as he's even hanging there on the cross? Here's Jesus, a wretched sight if you were standing there watching, declaring that he's not in the hands of his enemies being defeated. He's actually in the hands of his faithful and powerful Father God, winning a great victory. God is the one who will protect him and save him and exalt him and vindicate him. God is the one who will show him to be the victorious king. And God is the one who will use this event to open a new way for people to connect with their God. Jesus is saying, it's all in hand. I'm entrusted to the Father. And he's confident about what's happening. Zoom in here on the final two verses of this psalm because we're going to pick them up again in this moment. At the end of this psalm of David, as he's kind of wrestling with how he's feeling and he's declaring his confidence, he gets to the end and he gives out a bit of an exhortation, which is to kind of say, hey, what I'm realizing here, I want to share with you. Listen up, let me instruct you and encourage you. And he says, look at verse 23. He says, love the Lord, all his saints. A saint is someone who's faithful to God, you know, holy to him, a Christian. Love the Lord, all his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but the proud he pays back in full. Be strong and take heart, all you who hope in the Lord. Be strong, take heart, all you who hope in the Lord. They're beautiful words to hear. They're going to be a big thing we need to consider, a big thing we need to take from what's happening here in this moment. And we'll get back to that in just a moment. Come back to Luke, and let's now look at this fourth category of reaction and response to this moment of Jesus dying on the cross, which is to look at how the people who were gathered around as witnesses of this moment are responding. And there's a bit of variety in the people. But one thing's for sure, no one's ignoring what's happening. Everyone's thinking, wow, something huge has gone down. And they're all coming to slightly different conclusions. Do any of their reactions kind of reflect you and your heart and how you react to what Jesus has done on the cross? Let's have a look at them. The first one is the reaction of the centurion. Verse 47, the centurion who was likely the one in charge of this whole thing. It's likely the one commanding the soldiers to have Jesus nailed to the cross and hung up there. He's responsible for all of this. But as he sees Jesus hanging there, as he witnesses the darkness for 3 hours, feels the earthquake, possibly hears about something that's gone down in the temple, possibly even hears reports about dead people running around now alive, hears Jesus' cry in his final first breath, and look at the conclusion he comes to. The centurion, seeing what had happened, praised God and said, surely this was a righteous man. Or yours might say, surely this was an innocent man. He looks at a crucifixion that he's basically responsible for orchestrating, and he just thinks, we've just made a huge mistake. This man is no criminal. This should not have happened. He's clearly innocent and righteous. And all the things that he's witnessing is causing him to say, this is a huge mistake. We've just nailed an innocent man, not a criminal, to this cross. And something huge is going down in this moment. Other Gospels will say, he says, surely this was a son of God. A son of God. Similar declaration to this. Like a righteous man, an innocent man. Yeah? That's a big turnaround for a guy who was responsible for hanging him on the cross. Now he's thinking, what have we done? This is a huge mistake. He recognizes his error. And the rest of the crowd who are there with him seem to agree with his assessment and think this is a huge mistake. So have a look at what they do. When all the people who had gathered to witness, verse 48, witness this sight, saw what took place. So they're looking at the same things the centurion is. They beat their breasts and they went away. It's kind of first century kind of imagery for, we've just done something incredibly wrong and bad. The only other incident you get in Luke's gospel where someone's beating their breast is Luke 18, where you get the tax collector and the Pharisee who go to the temple and they're praying at the temple. And the Pharisee's thinking he's awesome, goes away all puffed up. The tax collector, who knows full well his wretchedness and his sin, he just goes away beating his breast saying, I'm a sinner, I'm a shocker. I make horrific mistakes. And it's as though all the crowd here are doing the same thing. They're just going, oh, we've just had a nightmare. We've just made a huge mistake. Likely some of these people were there in the crowd a few hours earlier yelling, crucify him, crucify him. Now they're just going, oh, what have we done? What have we done? Huge mistake. Where were Jesus' followers? Where were his friends? Well, verse 49 tells us where they are. But all those who knew Jesus, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance watching these things. They're not even there up close. They're standing at a distance. The ones who are meant to be with him, following him, the ones who were the followers of Jesus are now standing at a distance, likely because they're just scared. They're frightened. They're frightened about being associated with a man who's actually been executed, because it could reflect very badly on them. They too could be punished in some kind of sense. So they're standing off at a distance, watching, scared, probably deeply saddened as well. They had hoped that Jesus was going to be their Messiah. He was going to be the one who would lead God's people and sit on the throne in Jerusalem. And now here he is being murdered. And they don't seem to have any understanding about what he'd said previously about how this was going to happen and then he was going to rise from the dead. Because later on you find out that these are the people, look at verse 55, the women who had come with Jesus from Galilee followed Joseph and saw the tomb and how his body was going to be laid, and then they went home and prepared spices and perfumes. And so that they kind of see where Jesus' body gets taken so that they can come back and put spices and perfume on the dead body, which is what you did in that day. They're not expecting him to come back from the dead at all. They're thinking it's all over. So this crowd of Jesus' followers, the ones who are meant to be with him, they don't get it. They're just horrified, saddened, scared at a distance. The one that stands out from them all, though, is Joseph. And we get told about Joseph in verse 50. And I think he's the most unlikely supporter of Jesus. He's almost the most unlikely guy to get it. But he seems to, because he's the only one who kind of comes out publicly in support of this executed man and takes a great risk and does something very costly to stand publicly with Jesus. Look at verse 50. Now there was a man named Joseph, a member of the council, a good and upright man who had not consented to their decision and action. So Joseph is one of the members of the Sanhedrin council, the Jewish court with all the Jewish leaders, Pharisees, Sadducees, elders, teachers. He was one of that council who were the ones who took Jesus from the garden and in the middle of the night had their own little corrupt trial and got him passed off onto the Romans. He's part of that council. Now, either they didn't wake him up in the middle of the night to get him to come out to this council, or his voice was not heard in that moment. But whatever it is, it's very clear that he did not agree with the sentencing of Jesus, the accusations that were going against Jesus and the passing off of him to the Romans. It says very clear that he was not keen. He did not agree. He came from the Judean town of Arimathea and he's waiting for the kingdom of God. So everything about it says this guy was genuine. He obviously didn't think Jesus was what the rest of the council did. He was thinking this possibly Jesus is the real deal. He's waiting for the kingdom of God. He's a righteous man. And look what he does. Going to Pilate, he asks for Jesus' body. So that's risky, to stand up publicly and be associated with a man who's just been condemned to death. To now come and say, I'm with him and I want to look after his body. Very risky for his reputation with all his other Jewish leaders, and also with Pilate himself. But Pilate gives him permission. And verse 53, you see what he does, which is very costly to him. He took it down, that's Jesus' body, and he wraps it in linen cloth, very expensive to do that, and he places it in a tomb cut in rock. That's an expensive burial place. There's no one been buried in there yet. He's likely had that carved out for him and his family ahead of time, which is what you do when you're rich. But he decides to get Jesus' body and place Jesus' body, his dead body, in that tomb. Risky, expensive, but he's coming out and publicly making a stand to side with Jesus. It also probably is fulfilling some of what's said in Isaiah 53, where Jesus will be buried among the rich. So we've seen a couple of responses there from the people who were right there in the moment watching what was happening. Some of them came to the conclusion, this is a huge mistake. This guy was innocent. And that might be you. You might be thinking, I don't know too much about all this, but it seems like Jesus was a pretty good guy. I don't really know why they killed him. Or you might be someone who claims to be a follower of Jesus, but you're somewhat like his followers here. You claim to be a follower, but really you're ashamed to be associated with him. And you do little subtle things every day, right throughout the week, to actually not be associated with him. So to remove any opportunity for you to pay any cost or price, usually relationally, to be identified as a follower of Jesus. And so you effectively are, when you're here, you're happy to kind of make it really clear, yeah, I'm a Christian, but during the week, you're standing at a distance, minimizing any association with Jesus. Is that you? And you do it out of fear. You do it because you're scared about what might happen if people find out. Or you might be like Joseph. You might be someone who's prepared to take a stand, a public stand, and take a risk, because there's always risk to stand with Jesus, and pay the cost. If for Joseph it was financial, it will be for us too. But there's financial cost, there's time cost, there's resource, there's every kind of cost to take your stand with Jesus. Do any of these reactions kind of reflect where you're at? There's one big thing that I want us to go towards now, and I'm looking at the time and I think I'm going okay, so we're going to go there. And there's lots of different ways that you can see the significance of this moment as Jesus hangs on the cross. There are so many huge things to get out of it. What I want to do is zoom in on the significance of what the curtain in the temple tells us about what Jesus' death achieves, which is access to a holy God. And one of the ways I want to do that is to take you to Hebrews, and we'll kind of wrap up on Hebrews. So come to Hebrews chapter 10 with me. And Hebrews is, you know, the classic book to go to for seeing how Old Testament imagery and the sacrificial system particularly and the function of the temple particularly all relates to Jesus and is fulfilled in Jesus. And if we saw earlier that the tearing of the curtain temple means now that we can enter in, look at this language here in Hebrews chapter 10 verse 19, because it states what Jesus has done in relation to the temple, and then it gives us a whole bunch of instruction and exhortation about how we are to now live in light of that. Verse 19, look at this. Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way, open for us through the curtain that is his body. There you go. If you thought earlier when I was talking about the curtain, temple curtain being torn and the city, here's where you, living this side and having the New Testament documents for us, we see exactly the significance. Can you see that? It's Jesus' body. It's his blood shed that means there's a new curtain. Jesus' body was the curtain now. And it's a curtain we can walk through. It's a curtain that means we can actually step into the presence of the Holy God with confidence. Confidence not in who we are, but in what Jesus has done for us. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, which is another way to unpack what Jesus has done, he's not only the sacrifice, the curtain, he's the high priest, he's the temple, he's everything. He replaces all of this. Verse 22, we get a whole bunch of, let us do this, let us do that. In reflection on these things, what do you reckon it means for us? Verse 22, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart. Look at verse 23, we'll dig into this. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope that we profess. Look at verse 24. Let us consider how we may spur one another on. Verse 25, let us not give up. Halfway through verse 25, let us encourage. There's five let us's, five lettuces that kind of flow on from what Jesus has done here in the temple. If it's true that that curtain in the temple's now gone and we've got access to God, then let's. These things. Let's, number one, it's kind of obvious. It's in relation how we relate to God and how we relate to each other. Firstly, let us, spitting all over things up here, I'm that excited. This is exciting stuff. Let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience and having our bodies washed with pure water. If you come to put your trust in Jesus, you get washed, yeah? You might still live with the presence of sin, but things are changing. And the big thing that's changed is the punishment that's due for your sin has now been removed. It's like you've been washed and now that's gone. And because that's been washed away, and because the blood of Jesus and his sacrifice has changed you, and he now lives in you by his Holy Spirit, you can draw near to God. And that just makes sense, doesn't it? If there is now access to a holy God, and we can step in with confidence through Jesus, then let's draw near. Let's step in. I mean, you'd be silly not to, wouldn't you? If that kind of access is now available, You'd be a lunatic to stand back and go, man, the holy God is inviting you in through his son Jesus. Let's draw near to him. Let's enter into him and stay with him. The next "let us" is in line with this as well. It says, verse 23, "Let us hold unswervingly to the hope that we profess, for he who promised is faithful," which is to kind of say, let us draw near to God and let us stay near to God. Let us hold unswervingly to that faith, that trust in Jesus, the one who grants us the access. Let's hang on to that. Let's persevere in this faith. Let's never let go of what we now have in Jesus. Let's never stop pressing into God and drawing near to him and leaning into him and having life in him. A few weeks ago, we looked at Jesus with his disciples in the garden, and he tells them how to pray in hard times, and he says, pray you don't fall into temptation. And he had in mind there particularly the temptation to let go of your faith, the temptation to cease persevering in drawing near to God. Yeah, don't do that. Don't ever stop leaning into God. Keep persevering in him. Draw near to him and stay near to him. There's the first big two. And the second three are all to do with this. If the way is now open to God, it's not simply about drawing near to him. What goes with that is this: we draw near to each other. So the next three "let us" is to do with how we are to connect with each other and be there for each other. Have a read of it with me. Verse 24, "Let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds." So here's the thing. If the way is now open, draw near to God and spend time considering how you can spur your brothers and sisters on toward love and good deeds. Do you know what a spur is? If you pop it under the saddle of a horse and then sit on the saddle, that horse is going to take off, right? Cowboys have spurs on their boots, and I know that not because I'm a cowboy, right? I know that just because I've seen cowboys in movies and stuff, right? But they have a spur on the back of their boots, and when they want their horse to go, they just give it some, and the horse just giddies up. We are meant to spur each other on in that way. Do you do that? Do you live and act and speak in a way towards your brothers and sisters that just gives them a good G up and gets them going? Apparently, our temptation will be to G down, slow down, relax, not run, just drift off. And a very key role that we all play in each other's persevering in the faith is that we spur each other on. I used to think of it like lighting crackers and sticking them under your, because I used to do that all the time. Like, I'm old enough to remember cracker night, yeah, which is the night where you get to light crackers and chuck them at all your mates. That's the idea. We used to have ball shooters. I don't know why I'm talking about this, but you've got to talk about it. Ball shooters, which are these big, you could buy them from the corner shop. How good is this? And you just light the thing, and it just starts popping big fireballs. And you just, I remember being in the street, you know, just having these fair dinkum wars with, like, firing. I can't believe they just banned all that kind of stuff, you know, like. I did burn my hand very badly one fight, but it was all worth it. You're thinking, we used to get these little crackers. You light them and you throw them underneath your mate when he's standing there from behind. And when someone lets a cracker off underneath you, you just can't help but to jump and get running. And I think spiritually, here's what we're meant to be doing with it: lighting little spiritual crackers and flicking them under your brothers and sisters, especially the ones that are slowing down in their faith. You know, just give them a good whack. That's part of our role. We need each other to be spurred on in the faith, because our temptation will be to slow down, drift away, stop seeing the importance of these things. Look at this. Look at the next one, verse 25. "Let us not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing." Now, it is hard to spur your brothers and sisters on if you've given up meeting together. Apparently, it would be our temptation to give up meeting together. For some, to give up altogether. Why would we be tempted to give up? Well, it's not easy to go on meeting together. It's not easy. And some of you are feeling that right now. You're like, it took everything I had to get here tonight. Wasn't sure if I was going to make it. It's hard. There's a lot of reasons why it's hard to keep persevering in gathering together. But we're told not to give up, even though it's hard. Now, some of you might not feel that temptation to give up altogether, but you might feel the temptation weekly to just give up in a particular day. Like church is coming tonight, it's been busy, feeling a bit tired, and you too easily give up. I got tonight. Or growth group's coming, you know. Or you've organized something with your brothers and sisters, you know it's a helpful thing. You give up too easily. Friends, if you give up too easily meeting together with your brothers and sisters, it will impact your ability to draw near to God. And it certainly, clearly will impact your ability to spur on your brothers and sisters. Pretty hard to spur them on when you're not with them. That's how we spur each other on. We get together. And I've got to tell you, the number of times I've been spurred on by simply seeing someone arrive. You spur your brothers and sisters on by just walking through the doors into someone's house for growth group, through these doors for church. And friends, this is our flagship gathering for the week, our moment where we gather on the weekend. Don't give up meeting together. Spur one another on. And the final one's just in line with this. Let us encourage one another all the more as you see the day approaching. That's what's going to drive us. We're going to see the day approaching. The day being the day of the Lord, the day where the final judgment of God will be poured out, partially fulfilled in the cross, or even finally fulfilled, but then totally wrapped up on the final day, the day of the Lord, where his judgment gets poured out completely. Friends, that day is coming. And if we trust that it's coming and count that it's coming, then we're going to use our days here wisely. And we're going to use every day we can to encourage one another and spur one another on, knowing that every day matters. And we desperately need each other to keep drawing near to God and keep drawing near to each other. Friends, I hope that's encouraging to see that as a direct application from what the cross of Christ does in removing that temple curtain, allowing us access to God, draw near. Draw near to him and keep drawing near to him. Draw near to each other and keep drawing near to each other.